We'll be going through Psalm chapter 20 before we start our study on 2 Corinthians, so I'll have a few more to go. Psalm chapter 15, let's read our text to begin with this morning. Verse 1, O Lord, who may abide in thy tent? Can y'all hear me? Daniel says he can't hear. Can you hear me, John?
Yeah.
Hear me? Hear me now? No. Don't think my mic's on. I can hear me. Craig says it's okay. Let's start over. Verse 1. O Lord, who may abide in thy tent, who may dwell on thy holy hill, he who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. He does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. He does not put out his money at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things will never be shaken. Our psalm this morning makes use of, in Hebrew, what is called, in Hebrew poetry, what is called parallelism. And if you look at the psalm, it begins with asking us a question: God, who may abide in your tent, who may dwell in your holy hill? And then he gives what appears to be an answer. And the answer is a lot of characteristics that you and I are actions that you and I can either take or not take, that it seems that qualifies us to dwell in God's holy hill or to be in the presence of God. And the question might become, well, how many of these things are there? There seems to be several of them in these five verses, particularly the last verses 2 through 5. But if you look at something called Hebrew parallelism in poetry, and Psalms, of course, is a book of poems, Hebrew parallelism is two phrases that the Hebrews use in their poetry that were set side by side. And I'm going to give you some examples of that just to show you kind of how that worked. And the two statements may be, and often they are, saying pretty much the same thing, just saying it in a different way. Sometimes it is two statements that are set against one another, contrasting. And sometimes the two statements are more of a cause and effect. The first statement would be, if this happens, and the second statement would be, then here's what will follow. Let me give you some examples. You see I have something written down there from the book of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. Proverbs says, trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. Look at those two verses, and in the first verse, you'll see two things. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and set beside that is, lean not unto your own understanding. In other words, trust in the Lord with all your heart, don't trust in your own understanding. Two statements that pretty well say the same thing. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, lean not to that own understanding. Then the second one is another pair. In all your ways acknowledge him. This is sort of a cause and effect. In all your ways acknowledge him. The second part of the couplet is, and he will direct your paths. In Proverbs 3, 9 and 10, you read these verses. It says, honor the Lord with thy substance, and with the first fruits of all thine increase. So shall thy barns be filled with plenty, and thy presses shall burst out with new wine. Look at verse 9. It says, honor the Lord with thy substance, coupled with that, and with the first fruits of all your increase. Pretty much saying kind of the same thing, just a little different light on it. The second part is, so shall your barns be filled with plenty, coupled with, and your presses shall burst out with new wine. But notice the whole four phrases make a couplet themselves that are a cause and effect. Honor the Lord with your substance and the first fruits of all your increase, coupled with, so shall your barns be filled with plenty, your presses shall burst out with new wine. Proverbs 15:3 says, the eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. A couplet there, the eyes of the Lord are in every place, coupled with, the eyes of the Lord are beholding both the evil and the good. Proverbs 22:3, this is one of my favorite proverbs. John talked last week about the fool, and here he's mentioned in this verse, except he's called a simple person. It says, a wise man foresees the evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. In that four phrases, you will see a contrasting couplet. A wise man foresees the evil and hides himself, but set beside, simple pass on and are punished. But in each side of that, you see a couple. A wise man foresees the evil, and what does the wise man do? Hides himself. A wise man foresees the evil, parallel with, the wise man will hide himself. Coupled against, but the simple pass on, and the simple are punished. All right, you see these couplets or parallelism throughout the Psalms and particularly Proverbs. But we see it here in our text this morning. We're going to look at the psalm in that light. So let's begin. You see eight statements I've got on the outline, if you have an outline. Notice I've entitled the message, Being Comfortable with God. And let me explain to you what I mean by that. In a way, a very real way, that is perhaps impossible that we would be comfortable in the presence of God. You can look through the scriptures, and anytime anyone even thought they were in the presence of God, what happened? They got extremely uncomfortable, not comfortable. So in that sense, my title doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But on the other hand, God is referred to us as a father, a loving father. Okay? He's referred to and called the friend of sinners. Holy Spirit is called our comforter. All right? So I think there is a sense in which we can have fellowship with God and be comfortable in His presence in that way. So you see what I'm talking about. I've told you before about my own experience with my dad. And if I wasn't, when I was a teenager, if I was rebellious and not trying to live right, I didn't enjoy being around my dad. It's because my dad was trying to do what was right. And I felt uncomfortable in the presence of one who represented God to me. That's why you hear jokes about preachers. And I don't say this in a bad light, but a bunch of guys are standing around jawing and shooting the bull, and they're talking, and a guy walks up that they know to be a preacher, and what happens? They get quiet. Why do they get quiet? I don't know. They just can't find anything to talk about when the preacher is there. All right? I've experienced that before. That's one reason I don't tell anybody I'm a preacher. All right? They just have to find out some other way. But people get uncomfortable. And why is that? It's not because I'm so holy or the preacher's so holy. It's because of who he represents. So, our text this morning begins with the question, O Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? And these questions are questions of godly living, not of salvation. He's not asking the question of, oh God, who will be saved? It's a question of, oh God, who may reside with you, who may have fellowship with you, who is it that can come to you and enjoy your presence? And then he gives us this list. Now, I want to tell you that I think this list is not an exhaustive list. He's not giving us every possible thing that you have to, every possible criteria that you have to check off on your list in order to be comfortable in God's presence, to have fellowship with Him. This is a representative list. All right, now the reason I will show you that, and I want you to, if you have your Bibles, to turn to these with me. Psalm 24, just over a few pages. We're going to read a couple of verses here. Psalm 24, verse 3, we see two questions. Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, and who may stand in his holy place? Does that sound familiar to Psalm 15:1? 15:1 said, who may abide in your tent, who may dwell on your holy hill? And here we see who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, who may stand in the holy place. Very similar questions. But look at the answer, verse 4. He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul to falsehood, and has not sworn deceitfully. Very similar to our answer in Psalm 15, but not exact. It's a little shorter, a few less items on the list, but similar things, but they're not the same. Now turn over to Isaiah chapter 33. We're going to look at one more. Isaiah 33, verses 14 to 17. The last half of verse 14, we'll see a couple of questions. You see if they're similar to the questions we have in Psalm 15. He says, who among us can live with a consuming fire? Who among us can live with continual burning? Now, those phrases are descriptive phrases of a holy God. Then he gives the answer in verse 15. He who walks righteously and speaks with sincerity, he who rejects unjust gain and shakes his hands so that they hold no bribe, he who stops his ears from hearing about bloodshed, shuts his eyes upon looking upon evil. And he goes on a little further. But here again, you see similar questions and similar answers, but they're not the same answers. They're not the same thing. And so I think that the point is that he's not giving us a finite list, but he's giving us an examples of the type of person who can have fellowship, will have fellowship of comfort with God. So let's look at the things that he has listed. There are six of them that we'll look at. The first six is six couplets. All right, each one will have two parts. The first couplet, and this will be number two in your outline, is that it's a person with good character. Who is it that can dwell on thy high hill? Who is it that can abide in the Lord's tent? It's a person with good character. See what he says in the first part of verse 2. He who walks with integrity and works righteousness. Two things there. He who walks with integrity and he who works righteousness. Very similar statements. You could point out slight differences between the two. He who walks with integrity points to us of a person's consistent life. It's not just one thing every now and then where he does something that shows integrity, but he walks with integrity. This is a pattern of his life. This is the way he walks day in and day out. He walks with integrity, a person of character. The second one, he works righteousness. The things that he does, his life produces righteous deeds. A person of good character. It's the first thing that he mentions. The second one, this is number three on your outline, it's a person with a truthful and gracious tongue. You see in the last part of verse 2 and the first part of verse 3, he who speaks truth in his heart, he who does not slander with his tongue. He speaks truth in his heart. The things that he says, the things that he speaks, come from his heart, and there is truth there. It's a truthful tongue. And not just a truthful tongue, but a gracious tongue. He does not slander with his tongue. Any of us, you, could look at any person in this room, and if you knew them well enough, you could find some way to pick them apart, to pick at their life, to pick at their character. But a gracious person, a person who has fellowship with God, can see those things and not have to point them out to somebody else. Does not slander with his tongue. He is gracious with his tongue. This is perhaps the one that would get most of us. It gets me. I am prone to point out other people's faults when I don't have to. Not always gracious with my tongue. Number four, a person whose actions show humility. Look at the last part of verse 3. This person does no evil to his neighbor, and he does not take up a reproach against his friend. So it's not just his words, but it's his deeds. It's his actions that come from following his words. He does no evil to his neighbor. His actions show humility, show a humble spirit. He does not take up a reproach against his friend. Number five, it's a person whose values are seen by who they admire. We've got to think about this one. Who is it that can dwell in God's holy hill? It's the type of person whose values, you can see what these values are by who they admire. See in verse 4a, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised. Now we're going to talk about this for a minute, but this is pretty strong language, isn't it? It doesn't say the reprobate's ways are despised. It says the reprobate is despised. And it says, but he honors those who fear the Lord. So here's a contrasting couplet. Who is it that may dwell in God's holy hill? It's a person who despises a reprobate, and it's a person who honors those people who fear God. You will see my values by the type of people you see me admire. Let me give you a little exercise here. Let's suppose that I drop dead. And for some reason, you are given the task to go to my house, and you have free rein over everything that belongs to me. You can look in my sock drawer. You can look in every corner and cubbyhole where I may have something hid. Everything that I have is yours to snoop through. And you are on a quest. You're on a mission to find out who it is I admire. Okay, that's the question you're trying to answer by looking through all my stuff. Who is it that John Waldrop admires? Okay, now I want you to answer that for me. What would you expect? I'm not wanting you to answer who I admire. I want you to answer this question. What would you expect to find, or what are things that would give you clues that you might find in all of my belongings that would give you a hint as to who I admired? My books. Okay, you saw a Bible there. That might give you a clue. Maybe it would give me a clue. Do what? The history on my computer. There's a good one. Pictures where? Pictures on my desk, in our photo album. John said books, the type of books you may find in my house, the type of music I might would listen to. What'd you say? My checkbook, how I spent my money. Type of movies I watch. You think all those things would give you a little indication of the type of person I admired? How many of you think so? Some of you. Who does not think so? Don't be brave. Be brave. What else? Can you think of any other clues you might look around and find that would give you an idea of who I admired? Okay, maybe letters or emails or just things that would that I had hung on to. Okay? Okay. You should, yeah, you can talk to her. Clothing. Okay. All right. Okay, the type of clothes that I wear will give you an indication of what I'm trying to model myself after, perhaps. My what? Appointment book. You won't find one of those. But that would be a good one if there was one. Contacts on my phone. There you go. Boy toys. Okay, now, I want to suggest something to you. Y'all may disagree with this. If I had come up with those things for you, you may not, but some people would get their hackles raised up a little bit that I would mention such things that might show value. Not everyone, but some people would. To mention the type of clothes that I might would wear, or that you might would wear, might reveal your values. To suggest that the type of music that you listen to might reveal your values. But I didn't bring those things up. You did. Right? But I agree. I agree. If you were to watch a movie that showed a modern day contemporary teenager's room, how would they portray the walls of this teenager's room? Posters, right? Of people. People they admire. I wouldn't have someone's picture on my wall I didn't admire, would you? No. But look at, and I'm not getting on to teenagers, I'm talking about anybody. When we admire someone who is a reprobate. A reprobate. Many of the people in the movie industry, the music industry, are reprobates. They are. And yet the Christian community is just as fond of following them and supporting them as the secular world. He says, who is it that can dwell in God's holy hill? The person who despises the reprobate. And in contrast, it's the person who honors those who fears God. Number six, who is it that may dwell in God's holy hill? A person who keeps his word. 4b, the last part of verse 4, he swears to his own hurt. He does not change. This couplet is sort of incomplete. And you kind of fill in the words to make it two sentences. But he keeps his word at all times. And he is faithful even when it costs him. You know, there are some guys that are friends of mine, some of you, and other people that are not in our church. But I can ask them something, and they can give me an answer, and I don't question it. I don't have to ask them again. I don't have to wonder about it. It's because I have confidence that they have told me the truth. They are not beating around the bush. They're not, kind of coming at it from the back door or whatever. The question is answered. They will speak the truth at all times. They will keep their word at all times. I remember when I was freshly out of high school. I don't know if I've told you this story or not. I've been teaching here for 16 or 17 years, and there's going to come a point I'm going to run out of stories, so I'm going to start telling them all over again.
We all have
been. Yeah, that's true. That's when God leads you somewhere else, isn't it? I was freshly out of high school and worked with my dad. He was a superintendent for a construction company that built water treatment plants and sewage treatment plants. And he was finishing up a job in Benton, Arkansas. And they were just kind of getting through with the job. There's only four or five guys left working there. And there's one guy that was a backhoe operator. His name was Floyd. And we were kind of cleaning up the place, and one of the things that my dad had Floyd to do was to pick up all this scrap iron. It might be just little chunks of rebar that was, you know, useless for anything else. It might be, you know, cut off chunks of 24-inch iron pipe, or, you know, little pieces of I-beam, or just whatever, just steel. And there's a scrap yard about a quarter mile down the road. So my dad had Floyd, they load all this junk up in the backhoe bucket, and he just drove the backhoe down to the scrap yard and sold this scrap iron, and the money he got for it, we were all going to go out and eat lunch. Well, I wasn't, you know, in on this, and I didn't know about this till later on. But Floyd came back and gave each of us about 20 or 30 bucks. Which was a lot more than we thought we was going to get. And I didn't think anything about it. You know, I wasn't knowledgeable about what could have happened. But my dad was. And my dad knew that wasn't right. And he knew what Floyd had done. He asked Floyd about it. Floyd wouldn't admit to it. Just kind of grin and, you know, say, no. But he knew what had done. And here's what had happened. Floyd had drove the backhoe with the bucket full of scrap iron to the scrap iron yard and pulled the backhoe up on the scales with the scrap iron in the bucket. They weigh him. He goes off the scales, goes over here and dumps the scrap iron, and then what's he supposed to do? Come back and weigh empty. And the difference is how much pounds of scrap iron he had, right? Well, he comes back on the scale empty, pulls up where his bucket is kind of hanging off the scale and sets his bucket on the ground, takes some of the weight off the tractor. So it shows that he had a lot more weight of scrap iron than he actually had. And so here's this lady in there running the scales, and she should have known better. Maybe she did. I don't know. But he comes back with two or three times the amount of money that he should have had. Well, my dad, I didn't know about this till weeks later. My dad goes back down to the scrap iron place and gives them his money back. And he told the lady what he was sure had happened. He couldn't prove it, but he was certain that's what had happened. There's an example of keeping your word, of being faithful, of doing what is right, even when it costs you. Even when it costs you. Number 7, a person who will not take advantage of another's misfortune. Let's read verses, first part of verse 5. He does not put out his money at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. So what do we have here? Two things. He does not put out his money at interest. That on the surface, that's saying that if he loans money, he doesn't charge interest. What does that say about banks? Evil. Especially if you're on the borrowing end of it, right? Okay, I don't think that this statement applies to commercial lending. I think it applies to personal things, right? And I'm going to give you a couple examples of this. One, I knew a guy a number of years ago, I'm not going to tell you his name. And Susan and I saw him a few years later, and he had a different name. So I don't know what the deal was. He totally changed his name for some reason. But he was bebopping along through life, you know, and he had a mortgage at the bank on his house. And all of a sudden, he got religious, and he got Old Testament law religious and going to keep the Old Testament law. And, you know, he came to church one Sunday and asked me how we were going to celebrate the Feast of Trumpets that day, and I didn't have a clue how we were going to do it. And I was the song leader at the church, and I didn't know what we were going to do to celebrate the Feast of Trumpets. And ended up we didn't celebrate the Feast of Trumpets. But anyway, in his reading of the law, he discovered that this verse, in the law as well, about not charging interest. So he goes to the banker where he has his mortgage, home mortgage, and promptly tells the banker, I'll pay you the principal, but I'm not paying interest. Says in God's word, don't do that. The banker didn't agree, as you can imagine, and he ended up losing his house. All right? Another story about my dad. My dad worked at another job in Wynn, Arkansas, and I worked there with him. And there's a bunch of guys that worked, they were in their 20s perhaps, and I'll just paint you a picture of a stereotype of one of these guys. They all weren't this way, but a number of them were. They lived from paycheck to paycheck. They get paid on Friday, about Friday morning, around noontime, they started getting excited. And they were getting happy and getting excited because they're getting a check that day. and they get the check and go and cash a check. And this was 30 years ago when banks weren't so picky about how they cash checks. And by Monday, they were broke again. They'd spent all their money either on alcohol or pot or living it up or gambling or something. They're broke. Well, the next week at work, they'd borrow money from one another. And, you know, all of them didn't do that. There was a few of them that didn't. And the ones that didn't, here's what would happen. This is the first time I had ever seen this happen, and I could not believe the audacity of, on the one hand, of somebody, and the stupidity on the other side of the coin of people. But this guy would be broke. And it'd be Monday, and it'd be lunchtime, and he didn't have any lunch, and he didn't have any money to buy his lunch, and everybody went to lunch, so he turned to his buddy. He said, "Hey, you know, loan me $10 to Friday." So he's going to loan him $10 to Friday. Now, you know what he promises to pay him back? $15. "I'll pay you $15 on Friday if you'll give me $10 today." You know what kind of interest rate that is? It's a lot better than the bank. Right? Now, you know, I saw that happen week after week after week with these guys. Now, what do you think they felt toward one another? The guy who is doing the borrowing, in a way, he despises his buddy because his buddy is charging him money, $5 to get 10. And he despises his buddy for that. But if it was the other way around, he would do the same thing. All right? His buddy, the one that's loaning the money, is taking advantage of the guy who's doing the borrowing because he's broke. And he knows he can't do anything about it. And this went on back and forth, just commonly happened, you know, at the job. Occasionally, they'd borrow money from my dad, or try to. They said, "Mr. Don, would you loan me $10? I'll pay you back when I get my check Friday." And Daddy would loan the money. And I didn't know this for a while until I was with him one day. He'd usually give him about 1 week to pay him back without him having to ask him for it. But if they didn't pay him back, first time I got the paycheck, the next time they got a paycheck, he escorted them to the bank, and he cashed their check for them and got his money back. Now, was that taking advantage of them? Not really. I mean, it wasn't. He wasn't charging them interest, and he knew they were just blowing their money anyway. Okay? But taking advantage of a person's misfortune. Most of you know that I'm mess with coins, buy coins, sell coins. And I buy estates, coin estates. Maybe an older gentleman may have a coin collection. He's been collecting coins for years, and then he dies. And it's left to his wife or to his children, and they don't know anything about it, and they're wanting to get rid of it. They want to sell it. There's a guy in Heber, some of you may would know him if I would call his name to you, but he does kind of the same thing. And he has access to a lot of older people through his job, and particularly widows. And he has come to me before trying to sell me some silver. And he's bragging about how much he paid for the silver. Or he's bragging about how much he didn't pay for it. Taking advantage of an older, in this case, older women who trust him, and he's skinning them alive. He tries to buy stuff from me occasionally. I promise you, he will never get a bargain from me. He is, in fact, I don't think he's ever bought anything from me. He's tried to, but I will not give him a discount on anything. I don't care if he buys from me or not. I won't do it. I went to people's houses before, and this is always on my mind, is if I'm taking advantage of someone, this is going to be kind of a long illustration, but I want to just tell it to you to make my point. Let's say that I go and buy a bag of wheat cents. Everybody knows what a wheat penny is, right? They come in 5,000 cents to a bag, $50 face value bag. You can buy them on eBay for $200, $250 a bag. That's 4 cents to 5 cents a piece, all right, for a wheat cent dated 1909 to 1958. 4 to 5 cents a piece. You can buy them all day long. Now, if I'm going to buy a bag, go to some older lady's house, and I'm going to buy, or it doesn't have to be older ladies, to your house. You're going to have some old coins you want to sell, and here's a bag of wheat cents. And I'm going to buy it from you. All right? And you say, are there any rare coins in there, I reckon? I say, well, there might be. You know, there are three or four dates that are a little more valuable than others. And I've looked through, that's not exaggerating, I've looked through hundreds of thousands of wheat cents and probably found 4 or 5 that may have been worth, you know, $50 or more. That's lots of looking. All right? But if I'm going to buy a bag of wheat cents from John McCarty, and he says, I hadn't looked through these. I don't know what's valuable, what ain't. You want to look through them? And I said, no, I'm not going to look through them. I'm not going to sit here and look through them. That's 10 hours of looking through for me, and I can do it pretty quick, to try to find if you've got any rare wheat cents. If you want to know if you got rare wheat cents, you look through them. Okay? I'll give you a list of the rare dates. You can look through them. All right? Part of the way I might make my money is I can know what the rare dates are. I can look through them probably 10 times as fast as you can, and I'm getting paid for my experience. Okay, if you've only got 100 wheat cents, I'll look through them. Don't take long to do that. If you've got 25 or 30, I'll look through them and tell you. But if it's thousands, I'm buying in bulk. If I buy in bulk and I find a rare coin in there, whose is it? It's mine. It's mine. If I buy a bag of wheat cents from John McCarty and I find a $1,000 coin in there, he ain't ever going to know about it. Okay? It's mine. Now, if there's a little old lady that's got a bag of wheat cents and she's nearly blind and she's got a bag of wheat cents she wants to sell me, I'm not going to look through them at her place. But if I look through them and I find a rare coin, what am I going to do? I'm going to give her something. She doesn't have the ability to look through them that John does. And I'm going to help her out. I'm going to share if I find something with her. All right, I'm not going to take advantage of her. I went to buy some coins one time. This guy had a wheat cents in a little album. They're all there in a 1926 wheat penny that was just as silver, shiny silver as it could be. He just knew it was worth $1 million. I knew somebody had chrome plated it. You could take a little knife and scratch around the rim, scratch a little thin layer off, and there's copper underneath. But he was certain that penny was worth something. It was a mint error. They'd messed up at the mint and struck this coin on something else. There's no convincing him. And once you see that, you just back off. So how did I buy them? Okay, I bought wheat cents at that time for 3 cents a piece, sold them for 4. I would make a penny profit on that one particular coin. So here's how I bought it. I'll buy all these wheat cents except that one. I'm not interested in that one. Why? Because I would rather not buy that coin or any of his coins than to buy that one and walk out of there with him thinking I gypped him. He got my $1,000 penny 3 cents. He told me it wasn't worth anything. I bet it was. I'd rather not him have those thoughts about me for a penny profit. Taking advantage of somebody's misfortune. A man who wants to dwell in God's holy hill is careful about the way he conducts himself. The way when he has opportunity to profit at somebody else's expense, he resists that temptation. And lastly, number 8. Read the last part of verse 5. He who does these things will never be shaken. Here's my statement there. Who is it that may dwell in God's holy hill and have a comfortable relationship with God? It's a type of person who, if he does all of these things, if he lives his life this way, it's a person who doesn't have to watch his back. It's a person who doesn't have to watch his back. He doesn't have to try to remember the lies that he told so he can keep his story straight. He doesn't have to wonder if his past is going to catch up to him and he's going to get confronted for the wrongs that he's done. He will not be shaken because there is nothing to shake. You follow that? When you are buffeted for your faults, it is one thing. When you are buffeted and life slaps you in the face and somebody accuses you wrongly of something and you are innocent, I don't know about you, but it is far easier for me to take it when I know my conscience is clear. When my conscience is clear and I'm being accused of something or being buffeted for something, it almost has no effect. But it's when there's a grain of truth that it hurts. Even though it may be exaggerated and distorted, but there's a grain of truth there, and gosh, it stings, doesn't it? Let's strive to live our lives in this way. Be truthful. Be gracious. Let your actions show humility. Watch your values. Keep your word. You won't have to watch your back. Let's pray. Father, would you help us to do these things? Lord, we can do them for selfish reasons in that we will benefit from them. But Father, a far more pure motive and pure reason to do them would be because they honor you. They please you. God, would you just continue to transform our lives, conform us, help us that day by day, week by week, year after year as we walk with you, that our lives will become more and more this way. God, may we please you. God, may we see the fruit of it in our children, our grandchildren, and even in those that we rub shoulders with every day that may come to you because of our own faith. For your honor, I pray. Amen.